Welcome to today's program titled How and Why California is Different When It Comes to Trade Secrets and Non-Competes. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left-hand corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Robert Milligan. You may begin.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the audience for joining us for today's webinar. I'd like to start off by introducing our panel. I'm joined by James McNary. Jim is in our San Francisco and Sacramento offices of Seyfarth Shaw. He's a partner who specializes in commercial litigation and trade secret and non-compete matters. He's one of our very most active members of the trade secret and non-compete group, and he regularly advises clients on trade secret litigation as well as non-compete restricted covenant counseling. Also joined by Joshua Salinas. He's an associate in our Century City, California office of Seyfarth Shaw. He's also a specialist in trade secret non-compete issues. Myself, my name is Robert Milligan. I'm the co-chair of our National Trade Secret Non-Compete and Computer Fraud Group. And we're delighted that you're attending today for today's webinar entitled, How and Why California is Different When It Comes to Trade Secrets and Non-Competes. Now, people on this call obviously recognize that California is different as it relates to non-competes across the country. Things that you can do in some states, you certainly cannot do in California. Typical scenarios when an employee leaves and goes to a competitor, you may be able to sue for a violation of the non-compete, sue for a violation of a non-solicitation agreement, maybe even avail yourself of a doctrine called inevitable disclosure in your particular jurisdiction. Well, California is certainly unique when it comes to the way that it treats trade secrets and the way that it treats restrictive covenants. In general, employee non-compete covenants are prohibited in California, and that comes from California's Business and Professions Code Section 16600, which essentially prohibits those non-compete agreements. Now, that particular section has permeated in interpretations of restrictive covenant disputes in California law, as well as it has colored the trade secret law. But all is not all gloom and doom in California as it relates to employee mobility and enforcing your trade secret protection agreements. Because if you do things correctly in California, you can be pretty certain that if you have a case that you want to pursue against an employee, if you're able to bring that case in California and be successful, you're probably able to bring that case in any other state in the United States. And the key to successfully pursuing claims in California is making sure that you do a thorough claims investigation before bringing your lawsuit. And it's also making sure that you have appropriate agreements and policies in place with your employees, and that your company really has a handle on the information that they're identifying as a trade secret. And that permeates all the way down to the agreement that you ask the employee to sign, that you've identified and you've had that dialogue with your business partners as far as what information that you claim is a trade secret. Now, we've done this program in the past, and we wanted to highlight some new developments that have come up recently in California trade secret law. There's been some new cases as it relates to being able to get attorney's fees for the bad faith pursuit of a trade secret claim. There's also been a new case involving rehire provisions that are common in settlement agreements. A new decision from the Ninth Circuit addressing that. But the main takeaway that we want to get you from this program is how important it is to protect your information and what certain things that you could be doing as an employer now to making sure that your company is in the best position to pursue a trade secret non-compete claim in California. We have a general overview of what we're going to cover today. First off, Joshua and Jim are going to cover really understanding the definition of a trade secret in California and what types of information qualify as a trade secret. Now, California is unique in that it has a specific definition of what constitutes trade secret information, and there's case law interpreting what has been construed as a trade secret, and that may differ from other states in the union. There's also an important distinction between threatened misappropriation and inevitable disclosure. And what that means is that essentially there's a difference under the law as far as in California, they won't recognize inevitable disclosure, that an employee leaves and that they were so invested in your information that they must be able to use that information if they were to join a competitor. California doesn't recognize that, but they do have a very important doctrine called threatened misappropriation, which Joshua and James will get into. The next topic, and I think this is very important because it's really the building blocks, is trade secret definition, designation, and identification. And that's typically a term that comes up in trade secret litigation in California, the requirement that you identify your trade secrets before discovery commences. But it really goes back to formulating your agreements and policies in order to really have a handle on what is it the information that you want to protect. We'll also get into preemption, and that's a very important doctrine under California law. In many other states in the country, somebody may take your stuff, and that stuff may rise to the level of a trade secret, but whether it rises to a level of a trade secret or not, in certain jurisdictions, you're able to maintain a claim for conversion, tortious interference, all based upon the theft of that information. Well, in California, they treat information differently, and information has to, in many courts' opinions, rise to the level of a trade secret in order to be actionable in tort. As I indicated, we're also going to address some recent cases having to deal with the bad faith pursuit of a trade secret claim. And that's where a case kind of gets off the rails for a number of different reasons, but often because either the company hasn't identified their trade secrets appropriately or the underlying trade secret investigation somehow mistakes were made. And then finally, we're going to get into the lively topic of non-competes and restrictive covenants and what you can and can't do in California as it relates to restrictive covenants and get into this new rehire case that is captured many people's attention. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Joshua Salinas, who's going to get into how trade secrets are defined under California law and how that may be different from other jurisdictions.
Thanks, Robert. Taking a step back of what a trade secret actually is, it's a form of intellectual property protection that has become advantageous to some of the other areas of IP in that there's no requirement that you have to file or register for protection. Really, you can have indefinite protection so long as you keep that information secret and take reasonable efforts to protect that information. Under California law, trade secret protection is a creature of statute under the California Uniform Trade Secrets Act. It actually provides a definition compared to some of the other jurisdictions. And really, there's four main components of what a trade secret is in California. One, it has to be information. Two, it derives some independent economic value. Three, it's not generally known. And then four, it's subject to efforts that are reasonable to keep it secret. One kind of key thing to note is in that definition of what is information, is that word including? So this is not an exhaustive list of what could be information, but these are just types and examples. But if information meets those other three requirements, it could constitute a trade secret. So these are just a couple examples of what information can be. Many of us think of the secret formulas, secret recipes, but it also can include ideas and concepts, which is highlighted by a recent case we'll talk about. And it includes manufacturing processes, both know-how and then also negative know-how, anything that companies learned of how maybe not to do something. Blueprints and engineering drawings, software and databases, marketing plans, detailed customer lists and information. Again, these are just some examples, but anything, any type of information, that meets those other requirements could constitute a trade secret. So the next component is that information has to derive some value, independent, economic, and it can be both actual current value or potential future value. The courts have rejected any arguments that it could have value if it's historical information, has some spiritual or sentimental value. There really has to be some independent and economic value. Next, that information must not be generally known, as stated, and it must be a secret. And this includes two audiences, both the public and then other persons who are knowledgeable in that subject matter, who could obtain some advantage, obtain some economic value from the use or disclosure of that information. Again, the real core concern is, does somebody know of this information that could, take advantage and exploit this for their own value? So there has been a somewhat recent case that looked and reaffirmed that design concepts and ideas could constitute trade secrets. In this case, there was a dispute involving a business partnership, and there were some ideas and concepts were disclosed that the trade secret holder said was protected, that had value. It concerned the idea or concepts for this digital stamping technology. And the court in this case did acknowledge that those design concepts, those ideas could be kept trade secret, provided they did meet all the additional requirements of being secret, not generally known, and having value. And so this kind of reaffirmed the notion that you could have something that may just be an idea, may be a concept, may not be, written down or kind of manifested in some tangible media, but you could have ideas and concepts as protectable information. And so what this does is kind of reinforces and reminds companies that when you are entering into business partnerships or sharing your information, to make sure that you have a non-disclosure agreement or some type of protection to keep your information protected, but also make sure that any confidential information encompasses ideas and concepts. Now, another recent case we've seen in California, which has kind of taken somewhat of an emerging development and trend across the nation, involves social media and LinkedIn contacts. In California, customer lists have long been recognized as potential trade secrets. Many courts have looked at the time and effort to develop this information, when there's additional information in those detailed customer lists. With social media, again, this varies based on different jurisdictions and different states of whether and how social media contacts and information could be trade secrets. But in this most recent case, the cellular accessories case, the Central District looked at whether these LinkedIn contacts could be trade secret, and found that they could constitute trade secret information similar to customer lists. And what the judge really looked at and kind of was focusing on his analysis was that the methods used to compile this information, whether they were sophisticated, difficult, or particularly time-consuming, which would show the trade secret. Now, one interesting wrinkle was that whether the actual contacts were generally known or made public was found to be a triable issue of fact. And so that's going to be on the trial, which would be something interesting to watch. But we have seen with more and more of these cases that there could be a potential claim for trade secrets in the in social media context. But again, it's highly fact-intensive and depending on the jurisdiction. Now, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim McNary. He's going to talk about reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy.
All right. Thanks, Josh. Good morning. Good afternoon, everyone. So the reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy, as we outlined, it's one of the elements of establishing the existence of a trade secret. And in California, as compared to other jurisdictions, it has taken on particular importance. Some of the fundamentals required in order to establish reasonable efforts are similar to other jurisdictions, but given the tension in California and scrutiny of non-compete agreements, we've seen trends in courts, both trial courts and appellate court level, where courts are taking a very close and scrutinizing look at whether the efforts are reasonable and looking at things like social media and whether or not policies are in place to protect the otherwise protectable trade secret information. So with that being said, confidentiality agreements, non-disclosure agreements continue to be a leading indicator. Of course, because information is so facile and transmissible electronically, it's absolutely necessary to have very good, robust computer protection policies, limiting access to databases, not just making a login, for instance, using a laptop to access the network, but particularly sensitive data should be duly, that is, require another level of password protection in many instances, and then, of course, taking action against breaches. And again, to kind of refer back to the LinkedIn contacts case that Josh flagged, that was an instance in which a policy to protect the social media information that is LinkedIn contact would have been really particularly important. That case was a summary judgment posture case, and it has since settled, so we don't know ultimately what the court would have decided on a trial basis. But as Josh flagged, it was a tribal issue of fact as to whether or not these customer lists, essentially the contacts within LinkedIn, were in fact publicly accessible, known, or rather kept confidential and not reasonably accessible. So, again, it's just another instance in which, particularly in California, given Silicon Valley, the proliferation of social media, it's so encouraged in California that it's really important to lock down all of your policies, including those that you use for onboarding and exiting folks. This last bullet point on this particular slide, limit information made available to vendors, customers, subcontractors. We've seen over the last handful of years a proliferation of suits between customers and clients of businesses and litigating anti-poaching covenants. And those efforts, that is, those covenants appearing in those agreements, presumably were put in place to limit the transmission of important information. And so Robert is going to get into non-competes in California in much more detail and employee rating and non-solicit aspects. But again, as Robert highlighted in the beginning, particularly in California, it's extremely important to take a cradle-to-grave approach, looking at every aspect of your enterprise and every point at which information could be leaked and shoring that up to see if the information you've identified as potentially trade secret can in fact be protected as trade secret through your current policies, and if not, and your practices, if not, shore them up. These are just a couple slides to highlight some of the, it's funny, but not so funny when it actually happens, ways that information can be leaked and made public. This particular slide goes to being proactive. It's better to be as busy as businesses can be and distracted with doing, you know, quote unquote, real work as businesses tend to be. It sure pays to be proactive on the front end, to put your systems in place to avoid easy pilfering of your information. Lastly, before I turn this back over to Josh, it's clear in California that absolute secrecy is not required. You don't need to do everything possible under the sun. Again, the standard is reasonable, but again, consider that and contrast it with what I have just said about some of the trends and scrutiny about reasonable measures. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Josh.
So there's a recent example, the Direct Technologies versus Electronic Arts case that we'll discuss, illustrated some of the arguments that can be made for reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy. But in this case, the court rejected a lot of arguments that the alleged misappropriator had made, or the alleged trade secret holder had made, to argue that their information was secret, or they had taken reasonable steps to maintain the secrecy. What happened in this case was Electronic Arts was coming out with a new version of a video game with the Sims, and they wanted to develop these prototypes, these USB flash drives that would contain a copy of the game on that USB flash drive, but then would, on the outside, have a design similar to one of the logos, one of the images from the game. And so they hired a company who then in turn hired Direct Technologies to develop these prototypes for the USB drives. Direct Technologies made those prototypes, shared them, disclosed them, and allegedly what happened is that kind of middleman ended up going to a different company and using those prototypes and allegedly asked them, can you make these same type of devices, these same type of prototype drives? And then Direct Technologies later came back and brought suit alleging that that they had trade secrets in those prototypes and they were unlawfully used and disclosed. What the argument, one of the main issues, was that the defendants argued that the trade secret holder, Direct Technologies, had disclosed those prototypes but had not actually taken any reasonable efforts to maintain the secrecy of those drives. And there's really four main arguments that Direct Technologies made to say that no, that they actually had to take reasonable efforts. Each one was rejected by the court on summary judgment. The first was that they argued that there was substantial communication with defendants about a non-disclosure agreement that they'd actually discussed implementing or enacting some type of non-disclosure agreement, and the court rejected that, saying no, any communications actually occurred about a month or 2 months after the device was already disclosed. And so the fact that they kind of discussed this after the fact, the information had already been publicly disclosed, had already been disclosed, and therefore kind of these later communications weren't going to be sufficient. And one of the other things the court highlighted were those substantial communications actually did not concern anything about keeping the information, keeping those prototypes confidential. The second argument Direct Technologies made was that they knew the third-party developer that they had produced it for knew it would be inappropriate to send these ideas to a competitor. They had this knowledge or understanding that they shouldn't disclose it and they should keep it confidential. One of the things they highlighted was that EA had their own policy for keeping information confidential, for protecting business information, and what the court highlighted was that no, actually, it has to be what steps the Direct Technologies actually undertook. They can't rely on somebody else to have this understanding or enact their own policies. It really looks at what steps the trade secret holder to take to protect their information. Lastly, the defendant had told its employees to keep these things confidential. The court rejected that, saying no, actually, it concerned design work and not the actual prototypes that were at issue. And then finally, the defendant had asked the developer to have plaintiff sign a confidentiality agreement. What they had argued was that EA had actually asked Direct Technologies to sign a confidential, or some of the other parties to sign a confidentiality agreement, and the court said no, that Direct Technologies actually did not use their own confidentiality agreement. So you can't rely on the fact of with somebody else taking steps. It's really what steps did you take to protect your own information. So briefly to go over, if there has been an issue and believe that any trade secret information may have been taken or misappropriated, we recommend conducting efficient, effective, comprehensive trade secret investigation. The first thing is to identify what the trade secrets are at issue. As we'll discuss later, in California, you need to reasonably identify with some particularity what the trade secrets are in your complaint if you bring an action. And so it's always helpful to actually identify what those trade secrets are and have a better understanding of where they may be located, who may have used them. Often the case, you want to evaluate the circumstances regarding the alleged misappropriation. If there's an employee who has departed and you believe maybe using it for a competitor, you want to understand, how that, you know, circumstances arose. Were they disclosing it to information anybody before they left? Who was getting the information? How it was being shared? How it may be used? You want to gather all relevant evidence immediately. We recommend forensically preserving any relevant, you know, digital computer evidence, electronic devices, network shares, communications. One of the concerns is that when an employee leaves, sometimes the company will reissue their computer, reissue their device, and sometimes you lose that valuable metadata, forensic data, when that those devices are reassigned. Organizational charts are also helpful, so you can find out who is the manager and who may have, or supervisor, who may have further information regarding that former employee or individual's activities. We want to recommend you consider contacting or confronting the employer and or the prospective employer after you've completed your investigation. There are some legal considerations which we recommend you reach out to your counsel with, because there are potential claims with tortious interference or any interference with prospective employers that you want to make sure there's no any legal liability. We also recommend retaining outside counsel when you're conducting an investigation, and you also can consider referring the matter to state or federal prosecutors for criminal investigation. Quickly, one thing that often comes up is you want to take reasonable efforts to protect your information, but also in litigation. There have been instances where competitors have, you know, closely monitored dockets, looking at what their competitors are filing in the public record, and it has been used in some cases to show that information that is alleged as trade secret was actually previously disclosed in other matters. So you want to seal, you know, court records when appropriate and when necessary to protect your information. There's a recent case, this Overstock versus Goldman Sachs case, where the Court of Appeal heavily scrutinized, in this case, efforts by both parties to seal records. In this case, the court noted that, you know, one party was actually overly disclosing too much information that was actually confidential and had a disregard of confidentiality. And on the other hand, there was the other party was actually over-sealing records. And so one thing this case reminds us of is that you do want to seal court records, but courts are going to take a heavy eye and actually look closely to see whether you're actually sealing stuff that needs to be disclosed or overly doing it. With that, I'll turn it over to Jim McNary, who's going to talk about misappropriation.
All right. Thanks, Josh. One further quick note on protecting information that is subject to litigation. Everything Josh said was spot on, but the concerns in that realm also get exacerbated somewhat by a couple factors in our experience. One is the California rule of court that requires folks to follow a certain procedure when seeking to seal documents also has a provision in it that allows an opposing party to simply provide notice of lodging confidential information. And after 10 days, if the information is not affirmatively sealed by the other party moving affirmatively to seal it via motion to seal, it can become public record. And so the rule, which is California Rule of Court 2.551, has a mechanism by which it favors the public disclosure of information. And if counsel is not diligent to watch what the other side is doing with the trade secrets in suit, mistakes can happen. Second factor that often comes up, unfortunately, is if you're dealing with obstreperous opposing counsel who is strategically trying to lodge what you're alleging as trade secrets in the court record and being harassing about it and forcing you to incur additional expense to move to seal those documents in a way that you otherwise might not have to. So it's just something to be aware of. Moving on to this next subject matter is misappropriation. This is defined in California via statute, and probably many of the folks on the call are familiar with this in one form or another. But one thing that I wanted to highlight particularly is the improper acquisition misappropriation. You can think of the three prongs of misappropriation in California as acquisition by improper means, that's a form of misappropriation, use of the trade secret, that's misappropriation. Disclosure, that's also misappropriation, and those are not mutually exclusive. But the acquisition by improper means is particularly important when you're doing your assessment of what information is trade secret while you're going to protect your trade secrets, and then once there's a potential breach of your security measures, what actually was done. The reason improper acquisition misappropriation is important is that the ways that trade secrets are most often misappropriated in our experience is electronically, through jump sticks, through FTP file transfers, ways that are sneaky. And if the particular employee or contractor, business partner, whoever it is, has done something, either hacked through a firewall, wired around a password, or reached into an area that they should not have, or simply taken information with them in violation of their obligation under their employment agreement to return all information, those are all factual occurrences that you might use to justify an improper acquisition for a misappropriation, which then you can use to seek your injunctive relief. And as it pertains to this next slide, assert the second body of misappropriation in California, which is threatened misappropriation. One of the bases, the factual bases that you can use to assert a claim for threatened misappropriation is just what I've said. You have an employee who is now a former employee who you have a factual basis, good faith basis, to believe that he or she, for instance, downloaded stuff onto a jump stick. It wasn't returned at their exit interview. And based on your understanding, whether it be through confirmation from the former employee, or maybe it's even an updated social media post that they now are appearing on LinkedIn as being employed as a senior vice president with your competitor, you now have your factual investigation that you've identified information that was taken, was not returned, and now that person is showing objectively that they're now employed by a competitor. That is one of the quintessential fact sets that you can use for threatened misappropriation. So in California, as Robert pointed out, you cannot make a claim for inevitable disclosure. It's not recognized in California. It's been expressly disclaimed. But the next best thing that you have is threatened misappropriation. And quickly, inevitable disclosure is in its purest form, someone goes from company A to company B, and there are no objective facts to suggest that they've done something wrong. But by virtue of that person's knowledge, position, and understanding in company A, and assuming a very similar or identical position at company B, which is a competitor, in its purest application, the inevitable disclosure doctrine can be used to say, look, that executive can't work at company B because of that information. So, by contrast, here in California, you can use threatened misappropriation, but you have to have those indicia of wrongdoing or a substitute, a proxy for intent to use the information. One of the things that comes up in the context of improper access or improper acquisition misappropriation is, was there wrongdoing at all in the first instance? And sometimes we see a reverse engineering or independent derivation defense. And that, as this slide outlines, is simply, it is a defense in California that can be used to simply say, look, this trade secret, alleged trade secret, was something that the defendant came up with on their own, not using company resources, time, or money. And if that is established, it can be a complete defense. Very fact intensive. This is just an example of one of the many leak points that can occur in cloud computing, social media. There are many points at which information can be taken in these information cycles. We constantly see folks who are accused of misappropriation uploading stuff to file sharing networks, whether it be iCloud, Dropbox, and there are many others that are out there where files get stored sometimes automatically or at least claimed to be automatically by former employees as a routine use of jump sticks, sometimes just their file protocols. And so again, being very active as far as your policies and computer usage and what devices can and can't be used is extremely important. So I won't spend a lot of time on, but it's important to note that this is one of the developments in California that you need to keep in mind, particularly as it relates to misappropriation, but really into non-disclosure agreements and employee agreements. And this is something that Robert will touch on a little more closely when he addresses that subject matter. The bottom line is that California has, as articulated in this particular case, a pretty strong, clear policy that whistleblowers should be protected. And so this hasn't yet been applied in a published decision in the trade secret non-compete context, but it is, in some respects, on par with the National Labor Relations Act in Section 7, and not by your non-disclosure agreement with employees prohibiting them from discussing certain subject matter, terms, conditions, wages of employment. In this instance, it could be alleged that if the alleged whistleblower is reporting something that really is predicated upon trade secret information, query how that affects your trade secret investigation, your policies, your agreements, as Robert will cover, and how you move forward against someone who is raising a what might otherwise be a bona fide concern, but maybe using your trade secrets to do so. We've already discussed the inedible disclosure doctrine. These are just two juxtaposed views. PepsiCo is the quintessential foundational case. You'll see it out of the Seventh Circuit. And here in California, that was expressly rejected in the White case. So with that, I will turn it back over to Josh.
I'm going to briefly touch on a few points. First, under California law, corporate shareholders, officers, and directors can be held personally liable for misappropriation when they had knowledge or had a reason to know about the misappropriation but failed to put a stop to the tortious conduct. Similarly, employers and new employers of former employees who are believed to have misappropriated trade secrets could also potentially be liable if they do have some knowledge, if there is an awareness of the conduct that's occurring. We just kind of reemphasizes the point is when onboarding or interviewing new employees to make sure that you don't want them to disclose any confidential information or use it to integrate in their work from any former employers. Trade secret is also, California is also unique with regards to the current ownership rule. If there's a company or entity that has sold their business, has sold a trade secret, whether they still have standing for later misappropriation could be an issue. Often it kind of revolves around whether that sale agreement, whether the former trade secret holder reserved any rights to seek action for later misappropriation or whether they sold those rights when they sold the trade secrets. Also kind of one of the issues too is whether they can establish standing by showing later damages. And sometimes this can be established if the buyer who bought the trade secrets sues the seller for this alleged misappropriation that occurred. And kind of briefly go over trade secret identification. One of the things that's unique under California is that you have to describe the trade secrets with reasonable particularity under Civil Procedure Code 2019.210. It also imposes the requirement that before any trade secret discovery can be commenced, that it has to be the trade secret has to be reasonably disclosed with sufficient particularity. What it does impose a requirement is that there has to be some reasonable sufficient description depending on the alleged trade secret information at issue. Something more simple and not as complex may not have to be described with as much particularity, but more advanced technology and something more complex may actually need and have a heightened standard for requiring the description of that information. So really the purpose is to inform the defendant and put them on notice what is the actual trade secret issue so they can develop their defenses and prepare any discovery. whether this is a state statute and whether some courts have actually, whether federal courts have imposed it or required it has varied with some federal courts. Some courts have found that they are not bound by the requirements of the state statute, but have nonetheless adopted it or required it based on their own ability to fashion discovery under federal law. The federal courts have recognized, you know, there's four main primary purposes of this requirement to disclose trade secrets in California, and one is that it promotes well-invested claims and prevents the filing of these meritless trade secret complaints. It also prevents plaintiffs and competitors from conducting these fishing expeditions that maybe they'll try to get trade secret information from the defendant of their own trade secrets. It also assists the court in framing the appropriate scope of discovery, and then also enables defendants to form complete and well-reasoned defenses. And so one of the requirements is that plaintiff may have to prepare a trade secret disclosure statement before it can commence discovery. And so that's why we kind of recommend identifying those trade secrets as early as possible to the extent you'll have to prepare that disclosure statement. And so as previously mentioned, what actual is reasonable particularity may vary depending on what the level of technology or level of information that is involved, but it's really to allow the defendant to discern what is the boundaries of that trade secret. So I'll turn it over to Jim to discuss the remedies for trade secret misappropriation.
All right. Thank you, Josh. The next set of slides really pertain to two subject matter, remedies and then preemption. I'm going to move through the remedies pretty quickly because I'd really like to make sure we have plenty of time for Robert to address his slides, which relate to some of the recent developments in non-compete law. California, like many jurisdictions, has three forms of injunctive relief: temporary, preliminary, permanent injunction. Temporary is really strategically important. You don't want to move for a TRO without having all your ducks in a row. There's really nothing worse than moving for a TRO and not getting it. It's better to take the time that you need and get all of your information and declarations in shape in order to move successfully for injunctive relief. As far as damages, actual damages, unjust enrichment, and reasonable royalty, this is not unlike other jurisdictions, but one potential exception to that is the reasonable royalty aspect. Not all jurisdictions have that aspect. In California, it tends to be a little more prevalent because of a very IP-centric economy. And there will often be co-pled copyright infringement, trade secret misappropriation, patent infringement, trade secret misappropriation. And the courts in California have adopted a reasonable royalty aspect for trade secret damages where, in some instances, there has been a showing, a factual showing, that there is misappropriation. But as far as being able to quantify and show in a quantitative way compensatory damages, it is factually very difficult. Courts use this as a backstop to award damages where otherwise damages might be difficult to quantify. So trade secret preemption. Preemption, as Robert had mentioned, is prevalent in other jurisdictions, certainly. It takes on particular importance in California because California has this intersection between a very high antipathy towards non-competes and a very IP-centric economy. And so what that results in is claims that often are brought for trade secret misappropriation in employee mobility cases. The vast, vast majority of trade secret cases that we see are based on employee mobility. And that automatically gets into employment agreements and whether or not there's also an agreement that might be used to enforce the company's rights. So preemption in California is very expansive. It's the most expansive interpretation in the United States. And essentially what the test has been boiled down to, beyond what the statute says, it has most recently gotten to the point of being defined by this case and cases related to it. which takes a very broad view of preemption. That is to say, if you do not have a trade secret and it's information and you want to protect it, it is going to be challenged if it's in the form of a tort or unfair competition claim, a conversion claim. We have seen this happen over a handful of years, and the trend continues very strongly. There is no California Supreme Court decision on just how broad preemption extends. Can confidential information, that is information that does not rise to the level of trade secret, in fact, be protected other than under a contract in California? That's what this slide fleshes out. And compared to other jurisdictions, the breadth of the preemption doctrine is so broad that I think it's very critically important that when planning a litigation against a former employee or a vendor or a competitor, whatever the case may be, to be very purposeful about what can be asserted and what can't. Because in the worst case scenario, if you assert preemption and other tort claims, you could, in the worst case, found to not have your other claims viable because they are torts that are preempted, and then the court may look at your trade secret claim and say it's not viable either, and pretty soon the plaintiff doesn't have a viable claim. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Robert.
Thanks, Jim. Could you read this CLE code again for our audience?
Absolutely. So the CLE code is SS, that's Sam, Sam, 2372. I'll read that one more time. SS, 2372.
Thanks, Jim. So I think from now you've seen that there's some differences under the trade secret laws in California. The courts, as well as the statute, you know, can make it challenging to bring a trade secret claim. You know, other states in the country, they don't have the trade secret identification requirement, and the preemption doctrine is not as strong. Another thing that separates California as it relates to trade secret law is how the case law has defined bad faith. And basically what that means is, in a trade secret lawsuit, who's going to pay the freight? If you're a prevailing party, are you going to be able to get your attorney's fees? And what about if the defendant is the prevailing party? Are you going to be able to get your attorney's fees? And the particular statute is 3426.4, and it provides when attorney's fees are going to be available in a trade secret suit. Now, if you're the plaintiff and you're able to show that there's a willful and malicious misappropriation, you can get your attorney's fees. And oftentimes that comes up, and you'll see a trade secret claim being made where perhaps the non-disclosure covenant, the confidentiality agreement, does not have a prevailing party provision. So it may be attractive to bring the trade secret claim with the hope that you're going to be able to get your attorney's fees. Now, if you happen to be the defendant, you can get your attorney's fees if you're able to establish that the claim of misappropriation was made in bad faith. And another example that the statute provides is that you brought a motion to terminate an injunction that was entered, it was resisted in bad faith. You could seek your attorney's fees in those situations. Now, what constitutes bad faith very much varies based upon the jurisdiction, and really it's been up to the case law that has defined what is bad faith. And in California, the standard is you need to satisfy two requirements. There needs to be objective speciousness, and there needs to be subjective bad faith in order for the defendant to get their attorney's fees. And for objective speciousness, that essentially means a lack of evidence at the time that you filed your complaint, that there wasn't a sufficient evidentiary showing in order to maintain that claim. And then also subjective bad faith, that it was brought for some sort of improper purpose. There's been some cases recently. The FLIR system case was a case in which $1.6 million in attorney's fees was awarded and awarded to the defendant in that particular case. Some of the indicators where courts have been willing to make a bad faith award has been where the plaintiff was trying to plead an inevitable disclosure theory, where they really didn't have evidence of any use or disclosure of trade secrets, or really made a good showing that there was threatened misappropriation by either the acts or the deeds of the misappropriator. Other instances where there's been bad faith showing is where the information claimed to be a trade secret was really information that was publicly available. And the court didn't have to go very far to make that determination, because all they had to do was look at the internet. Defense in some of those cases have shown this specific information that they're claiming is a trade secret, I was able to print out on the internet. Other indicators is where the alleged conduct is actually lawful, where they're trying to make out sort of claim that there's a nefarious scheme that's going on, but the actual underlying conduct is something that is lawful. And that could be, you know, soliciting your competitor's employees. There's nothing in the law that prohibits competitors from trying to solicit others' employees. And so if the essence of your claim is that, courts have said, well, if you're trying to make a trade secret claim out of that, you could be on the hook for bad faith fees. Also, indications that it's being brought for an anti-competitive purpose, that the goal is to crush the competitor. Also, indicators where there's been an actual lack of damage, where there's been no loss of customers, where there's been no loss of information or any use of the information. Also, courts have looked at where in a settlement context, there's been demands made that are anti-competitive, and there's no justifiable basis to say that's necessary to protect a trade secret, like a plain non-compete, with there being no, you know, showing of any wrongdoing to make out a good faith basis to make that ask. Courts have always also pointed to instances in the court case where the court said, you know, I have serious concerns about this aspect of your case, or denied a material motion, and the plaintiff continued to pursue the case. And then also on the flip side of that, there's been, you know, a case where the court, you know, denied the defendant's summary judgment motion and denied the defendant's non-suit motion. But ultimately, the defendant was successful, and the plaintiff said, well, wait a second, how could this be in bad faith? You know, we survived these motions, and the court said, that doesn't matter. That just because you survived the motion, if the underlying merits of the case, you know, didn't have a factual basis, you still be on the hook for attorney's fees. One of our more recent cases that came out was the Cypress Semiconductor case. Came out earlier this year. And in that particular case, $180,000 in attorney's fees were awarded. The interesting thing about that case is that the case actually got terminated pretty early from the filing. A complaint was filed, and an amended complaint was filed, and eventually the plaintiff dismissed the action without prejudice. And there was no sort of ruling on the merits. There was very little, if any, discovery that had been done in the case. But it was a reminder that at any stage of the proceedings, regardless if it's at the initial stages or just in the preliminary pleading stages, you can be on the hook for attorney's fees, and it doesn't matter that you dismiss it without prejudice. Now, a very important topic, non-compete agreements. As we indicated, in general, you know, in the employment context, non-compete agreements are a no-no in California. That also applies to non-solicitation of customer provisions, and it also applies to no-hire agreements. Now, under the existing case law in California, you can still have non-solicitation of employee provisions up to a year. There's good case law on that. There's also prohibitions on saying if you go join a competitor, you will forfeit monies, either a bonus or a benefit. Long-standing case law on that. These are routine questions that come up in our practice about whether you can have a forfeiture or a penalty provision for competition, and the answer in general is no. And it really goes to the statute itself, and I think oftentimes people forget about the breadth of the statute itself, and it applies to any contract. a more recent decision than that we indicated in our introductory thoughts that showed that, you know, the full breadth of 16600 is this recent Golden versus California Emergency Physicians Medical Group case. And it came up in somewhat of an unusual context, and it's a Ninth Circuit decision. It came up in the context of a settlement agreement of an employment dispute. And one of the material terms in that settlement agreement with the employee was a no rehire provision, which is common in often in severance agreements and settlement agreements with employees. Now, I think the specific language of the provision is very important because it kind of shows you why the court had concerns. The employee waived any and all rights to employment with the employer or at any facility that the employer may own or with which it may contract in the future. So it wasn't narrowly tailored to just no rehire with the employer itself. It could apply to affiliates, divisions, facilities that the employer may own or with which it may contract. And the court's holding here was very interesting. First, it looked at the language of Section 16600 and said, you know, for those out there who think that 16600 just applies in between competitors, that's not right. It applies to any contractual provision that restrains anyone from engaging in a lawful profession, trade, or business of any kind. Any restraint of a substantial character, no matter its form or scope. So it was quick to point out that it doesn't just apply to competitors. It's much broader than that. And what the court concluded is that the clause at issue could create a restraint of a substantial character that could limit an employee's opportunity to engage in a chosen line of work. And it remanded the case to the district court to make a determination and do some fact-finding to see if this particular clause actually created a restraint of a substantial character on the employee's pursuit of his provision or of his profession. So what does this all mean? It means that if in your typical severance agreement, settlement agreement, you need to look at your rehire provision and you need to limit it to the actual employer because you're playing with fire and you're maybe making an educated business risk if you're going to expand it beyond that. Because then you're getting into an analysis of whether or not that provision is a restraint of the substantial character. This particular case could be limited on its facts, and we'll obviously closely follow what happens on remand. But it's just an eye-opener as far as the scope and breadth of 16600. Now, the seminal case in construing 16600 and letting employers know how broad a public policy that is behind it is the Edwards versus Arthur Anderson case. And it made clear that there is no narrow restraint. So those employers out there say, well, it's just a non-solicit with one particular customer, and it's a non-compete with just one particular competitor. That violates 16600. There's no such thing as a narrow restraint. And the exceptions to 16600, where you could actually have a non-compete with a high-level employee, those come up in the context of a sale of a business, where a high-level employee is also the owner of the selling company and is selling their interest in that company. And so those are the exceptions to 16600, and those are codified at 16601 through 16602.5. So there's exceptions for the dissolution or termination of an LLC, a dissolution or withdrawal from a partnership. And those can be important exceptions, particularly in financial services, accounting, in medical and legal professions. Those can be important exceptions to the rejection of non-competes in California. But even in those contexts, the non-compete has to be reasonable in terms of geographical, temporal, and restrictive scope. But there was an important case that we wanted to highlight for you, And it comes up in a typical deal context where a key level employee who's also the owner is selling their interest. And the purchasing company is trying to maximize the non-compete in scope and duration. And this particular case is a Philpoint versus Moss case, another video game case. And in that particular case, where the buyer made some mistakes, is that they only had a 3-year non-compete in the buy-sell agreement. And then they had a separate employment agreement that they asked the employee to sign for the new co, and it was 1 year from termination of the employee's employment. So after 3 years, the employee wanted to leave and start a competing business, and made the argument that, well, this separate non-compete in the employment agreement, there's no basis for it. You already got the benefit of your bargain in the 3-year non-compete contained in the buy-sell agreement. And the court agreed. The court agreed and said that, you know, really, you got your non-compete in the stock purchase agreement, and you really need to have a justifiable basis for that non-compete, and it's got to be the transfer of the goodwill. And this tag-along 1-year non-compete that you put in the separate employment agreement, it's double dipping, and it's not the transfer of the goodwill of the seller's business. You already got that. And so in that case, the court found that the employment agreement was a violation of 16600. So I think the important takeaway there is essentially that you need to think about maximizing the duration of the non-compete in the buy-sell agreement. And you also need to think about, well, if you do want to include the non-compete in the employment agreement, it really should mirror the same non-compete that's in the buy-sell agreement. And it needs to be focused on the transfer of the seller's business and not focused on the buyer's business. Because it's well established under California law that you can't restrict in the buy-sell context, you can't impose restrictions on the buyer's customers and employees, but you can do it on the seller's customers and employees. One open area of the law, and I know we're getting towards the top of the hour, one open area under California law is whether or not in the employment context there's some sort of exception to 16600, which would allow some type of restrictive covenant, be it a non-solicitation or a non-compete agreement. And, you know, the statute's pretty clear that that such provisions are void, but one open issue is whether there may be some sort of trade secret exception that, you know, the receipt of trade secret information would therefore, and the misuse of trade secret information may justify some restrictive covenant in the litigation context. And there's at least, you know, one case, maybe two or three out there that in the typical employee departure scenario where the employee clearly took information related to customers, where a court was willing to in fact enjoin that employee from soliciting customers for a period of time because the court was challenged that they could not unring the bell, that the employee had already taken data, trade secrets related to specific customers, and now wanted to go out and solicit those customers. And in this Pyro Spectaculars case, the court was willing to enter into a limited injunction on the employee's communications with customers. But that's really the exception to the rule. But, you know, based upon your particular facts and circumstances, it may be something that's available in a California trade secret case if you're able to establish that information was taken related to specific customers. And then lastly, a big issue in California law right now is choice of law and forum selection clause. And the takeaway there is that, you know, it's been well established under California law that, you know, you can't just bind a California employee to a non-compete by including an out-of-state choice of law provision. That's the Application Group versus Hunter and the Arkley versus Aon Risk cases that are on the screen. But the more interesting question is, can you take the dispute outside of California against the California employee? And certainly, you know, courts across the country have been willing to impose non-compete, non-solicitation agreements against California employees. You know, courts in Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois, they've all been willing to do that. And the cases are somewhat limited to their facts. But the real question is, what happens in California? Would the California court, you know, reject or accept that forum selection clause? And what we're seeing is that, at least in the federal courts, federal courts in California have been willing to transfer or dismiss challenges to the non-compete agreement by employee and the new employer, have been willing to either dismiss or transfer those cases outside of California. Now, this is an evolving area, and there was a recent case that came out in the California state courts that was in our materials, which indicated that if it's an expressed non-waivable right, that the forum selection clause cannot be a subterfuge to undermine that non-express waivable right. So the open issue is, under California law, is whether or not 16600 is an express non-waivable right that you could avail yourself of that particular new appellate decision. But in general, we continue to see federal courts in California being willing to dismiss or transfer actions brought, and it's basically under the reasoning of Atlantic Marine, which was a Supreme Court case that came out in December of 2013. And it's really focused that, you know, the court is not going to disregard a forum selection clause based upon some stated public policy of California. And that's really the nutshell and the basis, is that it's not going to be that you just point to 16600 and say, under California law, this forum selection clause should not be enforceable. That you have to do more, at least under the Atlantic Marine decision, to show that it violates the Supreme Court's reasoning there. And with that, I think we did get some questions. I want to throw that over to, we had one on LinkedIn contacts and whether, the question being whether, you know, since somebody's contacts could be in LinkedIn and could be viewed by the public or could be viewed by your own connections, would per se mean that they couldn't be a trade secret. And I'll throw that over to either Jim or Josh.
Yeah, this is Josh. That was one of the issues that actually arose in that dispute, was the argument in the court found they were not persuaded whether the LinkedIn contacts were actually publicly available or able to be seen by the public. The argument that the trade secret holder was making was that on LinkedIn, you can change your privacy settings. You can change different settings to actually show who can view your profile, who can see your contacts, and to what level they can actually see those contacts. So that was actually an issue of whether those contacts were publicly available and which ones were, which is going to be a subject, was a tribal issue of fact and would be subject to that trial. And there have been other similar cases involving either MySpace or other social media, and it often came down to what level the actual contacts were, in fact, able to be seen by the public.
And another question that came up with respect to customer lists and how California's treatment of customer lists may differ from other parts of the United States. Jim, do you want to tackle that?
Sure. So customer lists tend to be viewed in California on a sliding scale. A simple list of names that could easily be determined through the use of publicly available means, whether it be a phone book or internet searching, is unlikely to qualify for a trade secret because it's not going to meet the not generally known prong for the existence of a trade secret. On the other end of the spectrum, though, in California, there's longstanding case law that supports the existence of trade secret status for customer lists that are not easily reverse engineered and, for instance, would contain contact information for the customer, their purchasing preferences, purchasing histories, price points, purchasing trends, and really are loaded with more data that for sure is not publicly available. And so it's, if you will, a simple customer list on steroids, so to speak, and there's more information associated with it than just simply the name and contact information for a particular individual or organization. But having said that, even the name of a particular individual or organization, if the industry is specialized enough, that information could theoretically suffice as a trade secret if, again, it was not publicly available.
Thanks, Jim. Also, a question. If you can't have a non-compete prohibiting solicitation of customers, isn't that contradicting the idea that customer lists are considered trade secrets? Good question. So I think the best practice in California is that you can have a non-disclosure that states that you will not use or disclose trade secrets to solicit company customers. Now, certainly, if you have a protectable customer list, that you could try to have a non-solicitation of customer provision based upon the premise that the customers themselves are trade secrets, so by that soliciting, you'd have to be misappropriating trade secrets. But you need to be very careful there, you know, particularly in California, as far as what's going to constitute a protectable customer list. And the devil is always in the details, because if your names are on your, if your customers' names are on your website, if your customers' names are in your employees' LinkedIn profiles, you got to bet that that's going to be cited in any sort of lawsuit for, you know, trying to protect the customer list information. Now, customer list information is not just the name, though, right? It's a lot of the information associated with the customer name, such as pricing, such as margins, preferences, history, usage. You know, particularly to the extent that you've protected that information with a non-disclosure agreement with your customer, or that's really just internal information. But just the pure name, those are very difficult cases, so I would be very circumspect about using just a pure non-solicitation of customer provision in those circumstances. And certainly if you do, you need to have baked in a lot of recitals, acknowledgments within your agreement that show that, and you actually need to protect that information. That's where we see a lot of people, you know, going off the tracks as far as trying to protect that information. Now, with respect to Golden, best practices and going forward on Golden, and that's the no rehire case, I think, you know, to stay in that green area, unless you're willing to take on a modicum of business risk, to stay in that green area where you can say, you know, this does not violate Golden, you need to limit that rehire provision to the actual employer. So people kind of try to load up on what the definition of a company is, right? They like to say, oh, it's the affiliates, it's the subsidiaries, it's the divisions, it's the employees, it's all these agents. Well, I think then you're getting more into a realm of a relationship that that employee didn't have a relationship with. That wasn't their employer. And so you are intruding on their ability to get a job. Now, whether, you know, on remand, the court is going to say that's a substantial interference with their, you know, their employment, you know, it remains to be seen. But if you want to stay in that green area, then just limit it to the employer itself on the no rehire provision. And then, Jim, another good question: How should you evaluate to hire a potential employee who has a non-compete clause with a former out-of-state employer?
Yeah, that is a good question, and it gets a little involved. But one is, of course, even asking questions is being proactive. But to be very proactive, so before extending any offers, ask for such agreements and really take a very close look at what is the nature of the restriction. One, what exactly is the employee prohibited from doing? And then two, scope, duration, and the nature of the restriction. Is it tied to a legitimate protection, goodwill, and trade secrets? And equally importantly, given the body of law about being able to take cases outside of California, is there a forum selection clause? Is there a choice of law provision? It used to be maybe 5 years ago that it was easier to bring into California an employee that was out of state and subject to a valid restriction in that non-California state, and then seek to bust that agreement in California through a declaratory relief action. That still may be appropriate or viable, but it's really, really important to make sure that you're apprised of what the nature of the restriction is. Is there a choice of law and forum selection provision?
Another good question. Can you pay a departing employee not to compete with the company? Okay, so that's an interesting question. That could be viewed as some sort of garden leave, you know, putting the employee on the shelf. Well, here's the answer to that question. If your goal is that you'd be able to get injunctive relief, you know, to get an order from the court enjoining them in California, the answer would be that you're not going to be able to get that injunction. Because, you know, that type of provision is going to violate, you know, 16600. Now, whether the employee is agreeing to receive a stream of payments, you know, as either as the consultant or as a is still on the payroll as an employee in order to, you know, do other tasks or to do no tasks at all, that could be a workaround. But let's say that employee changes their mind after, you know, receiving six payments under the agreement. Are you going to be able to carve back those payments? Probably not, because we talked about the forfeiture provision, right? But what about on a going forward basis? What if they decided they want to change their mind and they want to they want to change their mind? Yeah, they have a right to change their mind. If you were to try to sue to enforce that covenant or to sue for breach of contract, you have a very challenging cases. Now, the more that you can couch it in terms of receipt of trade secret of information, ongoing retention of trade secret information, you may be able to try to make out a colorable claim. But in general, that's a very difficult sort of proposition, you know, to maintain. Oftentimes it comes up with, well, what do you do with, in a buy-sell context, what do you do with key employees that are selling their business and you're concerned that they're going to compete? Well, you can have earnouts where, you know, they don't get the money until, you know, certain conditions are satisfied, namely that they're not, you know, working in a competitive space, that they don't have any future right to that money until that condition is satisfied. Those are some workarounds you can think about. But, you know, the scope and breadth of 16600 always makes it, you know, in that sort of gray area. But those are some workarounds that we've seen. Well, thank you, everyone, for your attention. We, Josh and James and myself, we certainly appreciate it and look forward to our next webinar, which will be coming up in August on some nuances of non-compete law that we've noticed across the country. And then keep abreast of some of the latest developments in the nation on trade secret and non-compete law at our award-winning trade secrets blog, tradesecretslaw.com. On that blog, we cover some of the cases that were discussed today. Thank you so much.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.